and welcome to the True Blue LA podcast. I'm a very sick Jacob Birch. With me, as always, Eric Steven.
Hello.
You know, we're middle of November. We weren't expecting a ton of news, but we got some good bits, mostly Cody Bellinger, winner of the MVP. Eric, do you think Dodgers finally winning a position player MVP award, first time since they won the World Series, do you think this could be a sign that they're going to be stealing a page from the Astros playbook and winning a World Series sometime soon?
I will say the only, like, before the season, like, I did not see this coming, but it sounds like the Astros might have.
Oh, yeah. The problem with us switching to every 2 weeks is our jokes are like Jay Leno dated jokes, but I don't care.
Wait, what are you talking about? I don't get it. You mean hilarious? Are you saying we should have Kevin Eubanks on the podcast so you can laugh at everything you say?
So we're going to talk about Cody Bellinger a lot, talk a little bit about the rest of the awards season. We'll talk about the Astros and the sign ceiling and how many World Series the Dodgers have actually won, which is still zero, basically, in my lifetime. Then we've got Dodgers Rewind, questions from Craig, all that and more after this. So yeah, I wanted to talk about the Astros and just complain all episode, record length, 2 hours long of just me complaining about the Astros, and you wouldn't let me, Eric.
I'm usually the one who sets off our explicit tag, although just based on the headline alone that you wanted to use, we would have already been in the explicit tag, but it would have been fun just to hear you, because you generally don't, you, I mean, I've heard you cuss in person, but like on the podcast, you haven't really. And so
I would have a family show, Eric. You're a little...
I'm the smut of the show. Yeah. And so like, I would have enjoyed just hearing you go off. That would have been fun. But yeah, there actually is baseball-y things to talk about. So like, that's what sort of drives this, but yeah, we'll get to it. We do. There's a lot. I took some notes, and I find a lot of this very hilarious, but also like sadly hilarious. Like,
yeah, you know. I think you and I might share some similar opinions, and we'll talk about that. But you know what? You yelled at me last time I called it the final Cody Bellinger pace update. So yep. This is the postscript pace update. Cody Bellinger won his award.
Yeah.
What's his pace?
Cody Bellinger has played now three seasons in Major League Baseball. He's won one MVP. Like, it's presumptuous to say someone's going to have a 20-year career, and let alone a 21-year career. So we're going to cut Cody Bellinger off at 18 years. He's going to probably have made hundreds of millions of dollars by this point. And so I'm going to limit his career to 18, maybe 19 years. So I would say Cody Bellinger's on pace to win six MVPs.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, it seems good. It would be one behind Barry Bonds for the record. So,
God, Barry Bonds.
Although, you know what, Mike Trout has three.
We should do a Barry Bonds episode at some point.
Mike Trout has three. I should point that out. And is only he just turned 28, so maybe he'll have to break Mike Trout's record if at all possible.
I mentioned it at the top. First Dodgers position player to win MVP since 1988, Kurt Gibson. Couple other things happened that year, I think. Where does this stand, do you think, amongst the rest of Dodger MVP players, specifically position players?
Okay, so yeah, first position player since Gibson. Really, like, since they moved to LA, they've only had four position players. Like, Koufax and Kershaw won as pitchers. But it was Kurt Gibson. Then Steve Garvey had the weird year where he was a write-in all-star and he had a bunch of RBIs. 1974, they went to the World Series that year too, lost. Maury Wills, 1962, the year he broke the stolen base record. He somehow beat out Willie Mays that year. Like, when you look back, you're like, all right, I get it. But then that year, the Dodgers won 102 games. Although they lost in a three-game playoff to the Giants. So, you know, these are obviously very good teams. So yeah, like we've talked about this before, like where would Bellinger like end up ranking? Like, would he have the best season by WAR? Would he have the most home runs? He ended up like third in home runs. He was fifth in Baseball Reference WAR. He got to 9.0 there. On FanGraphs, he was 7.8. It's always weird how like the the different sites value the defense and like how they factored in. So 7.8 though, still, that's still 10th best. And he's actually like right there with, for instance, on Fangraphs, Jackie Robinson 1952 and Pedro Guerrero 1985, which is like one of my personal favorite years because I was 9 and it was my first full season watching baseball, and Pedro Guerrero had 15 home runs in June. So yeah, like it was, it was an awesome year.
Unlike the Rookie of the Year campaigns this year, I don't think anyone was surprised to see it. Not a unanimous vote, not really close to unanimous vote. Some really good contenders in the NL, especially Christian Yelich, who lost about almost a month to injury near the end of the year. That really probably cost him the trophy, I think, is the general consensus. Sure, he could have stayed healthy and then also tanked that month, and maybe that would have swung things, but he's a really good player. That probably wasn't going to happen. I think had he gotten those at-bats, he would have won, but that's the way it is. How did the voting kind of shake out past that?
So as it was, like, Yelich still got, like, he got the 10 first place votes, and Bellinger got 19. The only like sort of outlier ballot was Tracy Ringlesby, who had Yelich fourth and Bellinger fifth.
Sure.
All right. Yeah, whatever.
Who were her top three?
I'm trying to remember now, actually. Okay. Oh, so I think it was Anthony Rendon.
Sure.
And then Freddie Freeman, the second. And then Nolan Arenado, third. So kind of weird, but like, you know, whatever. Like, you know, it happens. Like, Bellinger got 19 first place votes, 10 second place votes. The fifth was his only non top two. So, it, you know, like you said, it had Yelich finished the season, he probably wins his second straight MVP. But yeah, like it ended up like, you know, just being able to be on the field and like finish it off, like sort of helped Bellinger in that regard.
So I'm looking at over our outline. You just have a bunch of numbers on this page. So I'm going to let anything else you want to add about this year and just kind of where you think it stacks up and how we're going to be, maybe how we're going to be evaluating this year. You talk about Pedro Guerrero's 1985. 5 years, 10 years from now, how will we be ranking Cody Bellinger's 2019?
Okay. So, like, I think, you know, where he sort of fits in, like we talked about, he's, you know, fifth in WAR, third most home runs. By OPS plus, he was 169. That's 10th best in Dodger history.
Nicest best, though.
Right. And so the one thing that sort of stood out to me, I mean, I don't know if I could point to a specific thing, but the general gist was like, well, okay, aside from the fact that, you know, the vote was taken before the playoffs, so people can point to all the, yeah, but he choked in the playoffs, and like, but then that got extended to like, well, Bellinger's season was basically only like his first 2 months, you know, when he was hitting like 400 through nearly the end of May. It was May 21st when he was the latest he was at 400. So I kind of looked at that a little bit. So after May 21st, that was the last day he was at 400. He was 404. He had his OPS was 1270 that day. So that was through 47 games. So, like, really awesome. After that, he hit 263, 371, 564 with 30 home runs, 71 RBIs, and 109 games. Now, far be it, like, it takes a lot of stones to look at that line and say, yeah, but what did he do the last 4 months? You know, like, he hit 30 home runs in 109 games. I know it was the year of the home run, but, you know, still 30 home runs in 109 games. It's going to play in, like, any era. And he did slug 564 with a 371 on base. So, like, to sort of denigrate that is weird to me. Now, what it does sort of look like a little bit is Bellinger's first 2 years combined. He hit 263, 347, 522. So even in his, like, quote-unquote four-month slump to end this year, it was still better on base by 24 points and a better slugging by 42 points. So, like, those – I looked up on Fangraphs because you can do, like, date-by-date splits there and get some rate stuff. And those final 109 games were a 136 WRC+. So, like, that's still really good. Out of all the major leaguers with 200 plate appearances over that time, there's 294 of them. He was 39th. So, again, still really good. And Turner and Muncy, for instance, on the Dodgers were at 140. So Bellinger was, like, right there with them. So to, like, have a lineup with those three guys, like, even at that level, at a sort of reduced level, Bellinger still made it, like, a very strong lineup. So, like, on its face, even that, like, if that's what you're hanging on, saying he really didn't do much over the last 4 months, that's, like, false. That plus it doesn't factor in, like, the excellent defense that he played, all this stuff. But I will defend it a little even further here because – so you look at those first 2 years. His big thing this year was – Bellinger's big thing this year was cutting down the strikeout rate. And basically, if you look at it, his strikeout rate the first 2 years was 25%. Even over his, like, worst – his quote-unquote worst stretch, his slump over those last 109 games, his strikeout rate was 17.3%. So he, like, cut it in a third. He cut a third off of his strikeout rate in his, like, slumpiest time. So, like, that's, like, perfectly fine. So that, like, that suggests to me that, like, there's actual improvement there, or at least sort of
in those
sticking
first 2 years included hot streaks too, right? Like, you can't just throw it out and not do that to the same. Like, you're especially with hitters, there's always, almost always, like, a streakiness to it, and you have to evaluate, you have to include the good. This is kind of the opposite problem, and we'll get there a little bit when we talk about the Cy Young with Ryu, where a lot of players wanted to lift him up, fans wanted to lift him up by discluding those four so really, really bad starts, and the problem is you can't do that. It's a single whole.
Yeah, and that's sort of the difficulty of a full season. Like, it's a full season. Like, you have to count everything. Like, you can have a hot streak, but still, like, it really matters what you did over the whole year, because there's ups and downs in every year. And his overall year was great. Like, he slugged 629. Like, that rarely happens with the Dodgers. That's the fifth best they've ever had. So, like, he was excellent. The other thing about Bellinger, I'll say, it was cool that they had, like, they were at his mom's house, his parents' house, I guess, and, like, his mom was crying, and so, like, that sort of set off Bellinger's tears, and I read, I guess, afterward that his dad, like, said something to him, former major leaguer himself, and, like, he was crying then, too. I thought that was, like, a really cool moment, and I didn't really see people complain about it. I was prepared to rant on here, but, I think that's good, because showing emotions is good, so... And it's very healthy, so yay.
And this reward really is a culmination of, you know, his hard work putting in, you know, how old, he's like 29 by now, you know.
Yeah, exactly. You know, he just turned 24 in July, so.
Mike Trout kind of has ruined this a little bit. What a joke.
Right, right. When,
but non-Troutian, that's still just really incredible.
Well, that's the thing, like, Bellinger, right, and on Baseball Reference alone, like, he had, like, by any measure, like, a fantastic year, a great epic year with 9 WAR, right? That's what Mike Trout's averaged in his 8 full seasons. So, like, good luck, everybody, like, when going up against Mike Trout.
All right, not an Angels podcast. Let's keep talking about how awesome Cody Bellinger is. Part of the third season, what does the future for Cody Bellinger look like contract-wise with the Dodgers? It seems like a thing that I've kind of always been beating on the show when the Dodgers continue to not sign big free agents is you have to assume that at least one big contract extension is on their mind. A year ago, it was like maybe it's Seager and Bellinger. Maybe it's only one of them. This season has definitely put Cody in the front seat for that. Do you see an extension coming? Are they going to do like they have with a lot of their other free agents to be and just kind of let it wait until maybe the year before?
Well, I will say this, like, I don't believe they'll sign anyone to an extension until they do, because they haven't done it yet, this current group. Like, the last one they did was Clayton Kershaw, and that was before Andrew Friedman came along. So Cody Bellinger, he's played three seasons. He was called up mid-April of 2017, so he doesn't quite have three full seasons, but he is a Super 2. He is among the highest group of players with less than 3 years of service time, but more than two in service time. So he's going to have 4 years of salary arbitration instead of three. Julio Urias is in the same boat, although obviously not the same circumstances. He's not coming off a Cy Young year or anything close to that. So we talked about this last podcast a little bit and what their projections were. Like, the Dodgers have 12 arbitration eligible guys. So Bellinger is actually projected to earn $11.6 million. That would set a record for a player in his first year of arbitration. And that sort of led me to look up some other sort of recent players. So Cody Bellinger, 3 years in, Rookie of the Year, MVP, and his resume. Ryan Howard did the same thing. He won Rookie of the Year in 05, MVP in 06. He was a Super 2 for 2008. So 12 years ago, Howard got 10 million that first year, and then through arbitration, and then the next year signed a three-year, $54 million extension, sort of avoiding arbitration. So for those 4 years before he would have been eligible for free agency, he ended up signing another extension later, and then he got hurt, which crippled the Phillies a little bit and him. So $64 million for the 4 years. Chris Bryant was Rookie of the Year in 14, MVP, or maybe other way around, I guess. Was he MVP in 16? Yeah. Anyways, two of those years. So he was a Super 2 in 2018, so just 2 years ago. He has the record. He beat Ryan Howard's record. He had $10.85 million that first year. He went through arbitration last year and got $12.9 million, so he's going year to year. MLB Trade Rumors projects him at $18.5 million this year, and then he still has one more year next year. So he's already at just over $42 million for 3 years, and you figure he'd probably top at least $20 million. So he'd be in that $64 million range, same thing that Howard was. So if that's what you're looking at, and if Bellinger's ahead of both of those guys in year one, and especially, well, for now, because he's coming off like the striking while the iron is hot here, he doesn't have leverage because he's not a free agent or anything. But I think that sort of makes it sort of plausible that he might. But like, from a team standpoint, the problem is this. Like, okay, so we talked about this too. The Dodgers, if they're using the salary, the CBT threshold as like a salary cap, because they did not go over 2018 or 19. So, you know, at the very least, it's a loose cap. So this year, they actually do have room. We talked about that. They can make some moves and still sort of be under the threshold. So if you count Bellinger, so for the CBT purposes, if he goes year to year and he does get $11.6 million in arbitration, who knows what he's going to actually get. But that would count as his number for this year. If you sign an extension, the numbers are only going to go up the next three years. So let's say they just sign him for the 4 years. And let's say he gets a bump from the Howard and Bryant numbers. So he's at like 4 years and $70 million, right? So that's $17.5 million per year would be the CBT number. So so even though you're only paying Bellinger this year 11.6, you're like tacking on another $6 million of empty space in the CBT number. So that creates a little bit of a problem there. That said, you're also saving money the next few years as he starts earning more than that. So like, that's where the long-term sort of planning of this goes. So I think the Dodgers would want to sign him something beyond the 4 years, like say a 6 year deal or something. And then it's for Bellinger. Like, is it worth it? How much money does he have to make to make it worth it? But then you could look back, like they probably would have, this same logic would have applied to Corey Seager after 2017. And then he ended up getting hurt like even worse in April and having Tommy John. So like, that's the risk. Cause like had the Dodgers signed Corey Seager to a similar type deal before 2018, they would be like, he'd still be fine in terms of a value standpoint, but in terms of what the team would have to risk and put out there, like it wouldn't have been as good of a deal because he hasn't been as good and he also missed almost a full year. So, like, that's you're talking about, like, why would the team actually risk that? Unless they feel like the savings is enough, or they want to lock it in to get that lower CBT number for in future years. I don't know. But, like, so I don't know if he's going to sign an extension, but this makes him sort of a prime candidate for such a thing. One more note on Bryant. We talked about this before. He filed a grievance because he's literally one day short of 3 years. And this was almost 5 years ago now that this happened. And it's still, like, being resolved. So, like, that's weird. But, like, so if he wins, it would, like, change a lot in baseball, because a lot of other players could be like, hey, you screwed me over too when you gained my service time. So who knows what's going to happen there. But, like, that's still sort of out there. But, yeah. So Bellinger, yes, prime candidate for contract extension. Will we see it?
Give me a percentage. Give me a Patton and Eric Steven percentage.
31.725%.
Okay. I'll take that. I'll take those odds. Maybe you and I will talk over the holidays. Maybe I'll lay you some odds. You, a quick behind-the-scenes look. We have made infinite bets on this show and have never kept track of them ever.
Never.
You,
not
you have made a Google spreadsheet to keep track of it. So I have to be careful anytime I actually lay odds. We'll have to figure out what the wager is actually going to be against.
What? Yeah.
It should be against something. It should be something good. We'll figure that out.
Firstborn? No? All right.
let's not.
Okay.
So I want to talk a little bit about Hyunjin Ryu. Do you have anything more on Bellinger before I do? I think you probably do.
Yes. Okay. I just will say this. we're gonna talk, I think, probably next episode, possibly another one, about, like, the Dodgers in the 2010s. And I did some research on this, and it turns out this episode was, like, we got so much stuff that we're not going to go really in depth into this. But I will just say, where do you think Bellinger ranks in home runs among Dodgers in the 2010s?
So combined, like, career, like, home runs hit in that decade as opposed to just seasons?
Well, with the Dodgers. Among Dodgers hitters in the 2010s, 2010 to 2018, okay. Where do you think Bellinger ranks in home runs?
Man,
I'll tell you, he has 111 home runs.
Yeah, okay. Years. I was a little – I was like, okay, around 120, and a lot – I will guess fourth.
He is fourth.
Oh, yeah.
Very good. Okay, since you're doing so well.
No, don't.
Okay. Okay, I'll say this. Where do you think he ranks in Baseball Reference WAR?
Ooh, that's interesting.
Among Dodgers. Position players?
Okay.
Yeah. Well, but without giving this away, like, for our team episode, I'll say the 2010s are very weird.
Yeah.
Because you basically have, like, it's, like, almost split in half. You have, like, this one group that was, like, the first 5 years, and mostly this group were the next 5 years. I would say Andre Ethier has, like, the most seasons, but those last 2 years were basically, like, him not healthy. So, like, he barely played. So it really is, like, a 5-5 group almost, like,
right.
With a bunch.
And Cody only has three seasons. That's why you have to, because you're talking total WAR, right? Not average.
Yeah, total WAR.
Fourth.
God, you're getting excellent at this. Yeah. okay. So my goal on this was, I was going to, I won't go through all the categories, but I will just say this. So I have six categories, home
he's
runs.
Fourth
hits.
In all of them.
No, that's his best in all of them. He lags on the other ones, but hits, don't think Bellinger right now, home runs, hits, runs, ribbies, and then both WARs. I want you to name all six players. There are six different players who are ninth in each of these categories for the decade. Just name a bunch of players, and I will tell you if they are ninth in one of these categories.
Yasiel Puig.
No. Okay. I will tell you this. Yasiel Puig is one of three players to be in the top five of all six of those categories.
Wow. Good for him.
Yeah.
Justin Turner.
Nope, he is also one of the people who are in the top five. He's actually in the top four of every category.
Max Muncy.
So close. He's 10th in three categories. He has exactly 10 WAR in both BaseMarvins and Fangraphs, and he's 10th in both, so it's funny he's 10th for 10. And then he's also 10th in home runs despite playing two seasons.
Adrian Gonzalez.
Oh, no, he is actually close in that he's like in the periphery. His lowest rank is 11th for Fangraphs WAR.
Man, I'm just dancing around it.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to do one more name. I'm going to think about
it. And then I'll tell you.
Yasmani Grandal.
There's one.
Yes.
He is ninth in RBIs, 245. Got another one in you? We're going make until you miss right now.
Oh, okay. Chris Taylor.
Chris Taylor is ninth in runs, 230 runs.
Let's keep doing weird utility players. Kike Hernandez.
He ranks anywhere of these six categories between 10th and 14th. So okay. He is very, very consistently where he is.
Yeah. I thought maybe he could sneak in the ninth on like runs or something like that. So
okay. So just a quick, since I just randomly chose nine, I chose it because there's six different ones in these categories, so that's why. Hanley Ramirez, 10.2 WAR, is ninth. You said Grandal and Taylor. James Loney, 395 hits, ninth.
Definitely would not have guessed James Loney.
For Baseball Reference WAR, 10.8. He was there for a long time. 10.8. Actually, he wasn't because he was traded in like August of 2012.
Thank you.
But he was a hit machine. 10.8 Baseball Reference WAR, ninth place is Jock Peterson. And someone who I've already mentioned on this podcast, 73 home runs, ninth in this decade, Corey Seager.
Okay. He would have been amongst my next guesses. Running out of players though, so.
Sure. Exactly. It's just funny because I was going through this list, I'm going, I didn't realize if certain guys were like as high as they were on a bunch of these. So like it was kind of illuminating to see.
All right. With that, we're going to close the Cody Bellinger discussion half hour and move on to other news, starting with the Cy Young Award after this. I have surprise news for you, Eric.
What?
Hyunjin Ryu did not win the Cy Young.
What? He came close. Come on. Look, he got a first place vote.
Does that count? This is horseshoes, right?
Yeah, and so it technically does. Mark Wicker, who a local reporter, longtime columnist here, SoCal News Group, they have the Orange County Register and LA Daily News, so I blanked on that for some reason. Among their papers, but he was the only first place vote for Ryu. He wrote a column about it. I will just quote what Ryu said. Jacob deGrom won, by the way. His quote, man. And I know deGrom, right? Seriously? Mark Wicker's quote, to deprive Rue of the Cy Young because of four games that meant approximately as much as G League exhibition seemed a little silly. Now, you brought this up earlier. He had the really bad four-start stretch where he gave up seven runs twice, and then like he was just – he didn't last long in it, but then he recovered. Overall, he led the league in ERA. Great season. Like, DeGrom had the stronger finish, better peripherals, more innings. I mean, I was not surprised Jacob DeGrom won. I was surprised he got 29 out of 30 first place votes because it's like, really? Okay. Like, I get it. But, like, that seemed a little out of place for me. But, like, the outcome was basically what we expected. So, like, no, it wasn't like any big deal one way or the other. Now, okay, so Ryu is one of 12 Dodgers pitchers to receive a first place vote but not win the Cy Young that year.
Okay.
This list includes pitchers who have won the Cy Young.
That was going to be my question. You told me this question was coming a minute or two ago.
Yeah. And
that was the clarification I needed. Okay. You're ready? So it's 12, right?
Okay. So my question to you, how many of those 12 can, well, how many of those 11 Can you, yeah. I'll even give you. How many of the 12 can you name, knowing that you're going to get one?
Ryu.
That's one.
Oh, yeah. I'm gonna roll. So, okay. We're going to do, I get three fails. It's a family.
That's fine. Perfect.
Family Feud rules. Okay. Yep. Eric Gagne. I'm going to start hard, by the way.
No. The only year he got first place, the only time he got first place votes was 2003, and he got 28 out of 32.
Yeah. I was hoping he had one more year.
Yep.
All right. Clayton Kershaw.
Four times he got first place votes and didn't win. And so he was a stretch where for 7 years, 2011, 2017, he got at least two first place votes every single year. The years he didn't win, he finished second, third, and fifth. So, yes.
Okay. Kevin Brown.
Nope. Oh, never received a first place vote as a Dodger. Yeah.
Oh,
it's starting to crumble. Yeah.
Don Drysdale.
Don Drysdale. Okay, so Don Drysdale is hurt in the fact that I should have brought this up ahead of time. So the current ballot, I believe, started 1970.
Oh, okay.
First, second, and third. And so before that, it was first place vote. And I mean, there wasn't even first, it was just vote.
Okay.
Like, you just voted for one pitcher. So, like, the year Don Drysdale got votes was 1962. He got 14 out of 20 and he won. The 3 years Sandy Koufax won, they were all major league Cy Youngs, by the way. He got 20 out of 20 votes. So, like, there were some dominant years. So, yeah, Drysdale didn't win. So
I'm not
do you
counting.
Want to count that as
I'm
a
not
miss?
Counting. Okay. No, yeah, we're not counting.
I don't blame you. I don't all blame right. you.
Don Sutton
twice.
Yes.
1974, 1976. He got one first place vote both years. 74 was the unique year where reliever Mike Marshall won, who pitched 208 innings. It's just funny to say because he was a reliever. It was Andy Messersmith who would become the first free agent, like, or who challenged the, he wasn't technically the first free agent, but like the first that mattered in that arbitration case that sort of changed baseball forever. Messersmith was second and Don Sutton was fourth. So Dodgers did well. They won 102 games and went to the World Series. So yeah.
Okay. I could run into the Gagne problem here, but I'm going to go with it. Fernando.
Twice.
Okay.
So he won as a rookie, 1981. 1982, come back. He finished third. He got one first place
okay.
vote out of 24. 1986, when he won 21 games, he had 20 complete games. Excuse me. He finished second and got 9 out of 24
okay.
votes. That
okay.
that was a very close vote that year.
Man, I'm on house money. I got a little further than I was expecting. So let's
see. Well.
Hideo Nomo.
No, yeah. Never received a first
that was,
place
that
vote.
Was a, okay. That was a hope. I didn't think he actually did. I thought maybe there had been one crazy person his rookie year. But knew it was a long shot.
I will reveal everyone to you. It's basically alphabetical order by first name. Al Downing, 1971. He finished third, got one first place vote. Messersmith, who I mentioned, got five first place votes in 1974. Finished second. Jerry Royce pitched a no-hitter in 1980. He finished second and got one first-place vote. Oral Hershiser, he bookended.
Definitely needed to guess Oral.
So he bookended 1988 by finishing fourth in 1987, 1989. He got two first-place votes in 87, one in 89. I will say this, like, he had a .500 record both years. So, like, props to the voters for looking beyond that because he had very good peripherals and good ERA and stuff. So, yeah, good for him. Ramon Martinez, 1990, that was another year where it was like he was very, he should have been closer than it was. Doug Drabek won. He got one first place vote, finished second. Sal Magley, who we may or may not talk about later this episode, 1956, the first year of a Cy Young, Don Newcomb won. Sal Magley, who the Dodgers got that year in May, he finished second. He got 4 out of 16 first place votes. And again, this was major league vote only. Sandy Koufax, one of the years he didn't win, 1964, he was hurt part of the year. He still got one first place vote or one vote out of 20.
Obviously, he was an easy name of Dodgers pitcher, but
right.
I just figured it was all or nothing.
And it basically was, except like that was a weird year. Then the other one, Tommy John, post-surgery, 1977, three first place votes, finished second.
That makes sense. I think I definitely should. Oral just completely whiffed my mind, but I'm okay with my guesses. I'm all right.
Yeah, no, you did very well. I agree.
All right, what other news? We got some other news before I complain about the Astros.
Yeah. So, Christopher Negron,
you wanted to do a special edition episode just on this.
You were on vacation. I did text you and I said, "Emergency pod, Christopher Negron retired." And sadly, we couldn't make it work. But yeah, so I was looking at this the Dodgers transaction page lists that Negron got released on November 8th, and he tweeted out something on the 12th saying my 14 years in baseball, thanks to everybody, that kind of thing. It's very heartfelt. It was nice. I always wonder about this. I don't know exactly how this happened, but did the release come first and then he just decided, you know what? Or it was did he just decide, he probably read the writing on the wall. We talked about him. He's out of options. He was a long shot to sort of stay on the 40-man. If they needed room, he was probably going to be a casualty. So I would imagine that probably helped his decision, not knowing which exactly came first. But, yeah, so he was 6 years in Major League Baseball, spread over 8 years from 2012 to 2019. Reds, D-backs, Mariners, and Dodgers. The Dodgers got him on July 29th. And he started 10 of the first 12 games. Remember how we were talking about, at the time it was well, look.
He would be on the team for 2 days.
They could just bring up Gavin Lux because we were talking about this because, they're not going to do that because they need him to play. And at this time, both Kike and Chris Taylor were hurt, right? So they had to sort of get by for a little bit, and then they got Negron. We're like, okay, well, it gives him someone they could stash on the bench, and then he starts 10 of the 12 first 12 games. We're like, what is going on? But then he also he hit a home run in two straight games, and it was okay. He ended up hitting 259, 298, 389, perfectly acceptable from a utility man, sort of down the bench, really. He only started 4 of the final 42 games, basically after the cavalry got healthy. So, yeah, he was, it was cool. He started at 6 different positions for the Dodgers in his very limited time. So, look, we talk about all the time they value utility. He started all 3 outfield spots, every infield spot but first base. So he sort of filled a need, and I think it's good to sort of appreciate those players. You're going to look and say, well, his WAR wasn't anything, but those players still are cool. They have good stories, and he was no secret to that. The Dodgers, the 40-man is at 37. That doesn't include Andrew Toles and Yadier Alvarez. Like I said, I'm not sure exactly how long they can keep them on the restricted list, if they still do it over the offseason or not, but that's basically where we're at. At worst, it's 39, but it's really 37. So that's sort of where we're at right now, the Dodgers roster.
Is it time?
Oh, it's time.
So are the Dodgers the champions of 2017?
They are not.
What?
It's funny,
So I don't know about you. So this story came out, and I'm like, oh, sure, that makes sense. Cheating is probably rampant in all sports by all teams. This came out while I was on vacation, as you mentioned. I think was a little surprised at how and maybe this may have to do with the fact that they've been in the Yankees twice in a row, but just how far this has run, and just how villainized they've become, as opposed to you mentioned earlier the sort of Apple Watch Red Sox scandal, mini scandal, which seemed to come and go in a week. This has taken the baseball world by storm, and maybe rightfully, but I guess I was just, I'm so cynical at this point that I just said, cheaters prosper, it's fine, it's gonna move on, they're gonna lose a draft pick and move on with our life.
Yeah, and even that, if you look back, so from a timeline perspective, 2 years ago, In 2017, the same year the Astros were doing their shenanigans. This is how like fun and dumb this is. So the MLB was investigating the Red Sox because the Yankees complained to them and said, "Hey, our rivals are cheating. Like they're using a camera and then communicating to the dugout, and like you're not allowed to do that. Like sign stealing, like I said, gone on forever. But the general rule is like you should be able to do it with your eyes, right? Like you have to like spot it and like react accordingly. You can't use like cameras to do it. You're not allowed to communicate with the dugout electronically. So the MLB, I almost keep saying the MLB, which is not right at all. But like
the Googles, the me,
yes,
the
exactly.
Baseballs.
And I'm just gonna, when we're done here, I'm just gonna go sit and watch my stories. So okay, so MLB is like sort of. I went back and looked at the like press release on this, and so they found that Red Sox did in fact send electronic communications. That's how they termed it, from the video replay room to the dugout. And so MLB, before it like released its sort of punishment, they said they had 3 points. One, the incidents occurred without ownership or front office knowledge. Okay, like sure. Well, let's just take that on face value, fine. Second thing, once the Red Sox learned of the Yankees' complaint, they stopped immediately. Sure they did. Okay. The third thing was the MLB got assurances from the Red Sox that they would stop doing this. So in taking all that in, they were fined. But what MLB noted in this press release is that all 30 clubs have been notified that future violations of this type will be subject to more serious sanctions, including the possible loss of draft picks. Now, it doesn't stop there, because the best part about this whole thing was the only reason MLB was investigating the Red Sox was because the Yankees complained. During their investigation, MLB found that the Yankees also cheated. But they did it separately. They were using the dugout phone to relay things, and you're only supposed to use it to like call to the bullpen, basically. And they were using it to like, hey, this, basically stealing signs. So, and they found this was in like years prior to 2017. So the Yankees also got fined, right? So this brings us to the Astros. So the crux of this, I don't know, this had to have been like an ongoing investigation, but it was basically Evan Drellick, and who was a longtime Astros beat writer. Now he's more national. He did work for their covered the Red Sox for years after. He started as an intern on MLB.com with the Dodgers under Ken Gernick. So, like, he's been around, right? And Ken Rosenthal on The Athletic, they had one story come out that was sort of the bombshell of this, that said that the Astros were relaying signs during the 2017 season. Mike Fiers went on record. He was on the team in 2017, so he, like, detailed what they were doing. Danny Farquhar was an opposing pitcher on the White Sox. He detailed a game against him. So this comes out, and it was like the best part of this. So the crux of this article was basically like they had a camera, and they were using it to pick up the catcher sign. Someone in the like area between the dugout and clubhouse, the tunnel there, was you're basically like within an earshot of the dugout. There was a trash can there. They were hitting the trash can with a metal bat. So all this high-tech stuff, right? That's how they seal the signs. And how they communicated was to bang on a damn trash can. And then the best part, so John Boy, this Twitter account, like just started going through games, right? And there's a couple of games that are so painfully obvious, like including one of the Farquhar games. And it's like, you know, they would bang basically for a changeup. For a non-fastball. So, sign for a fastball, no sound. Sign for a changeup, bang, bang! And then the pitch would come, and, like, Farquhar, like, figured it out. This is 2017, mind you. So, fast forward to now. In 2019, in one of the games Steven Strasburg started, I think game two, he was struggling early. And then they figured something out and they went to like a series. They just changed up their science. And like, I think Sean Doolittle talked about this too. Like they have systems now where you basically have like five different set of signs. You're almost not, the catcher's almost irrelevant in this because to try to avoid this type of thing, or you're at least secretive enough to where they can't fully pick it up. So, and he adjusted on the fly, ended up doing fine. And then, hey, look at that. The Nationals won. But so this is all 2017 stuff. So,
what happened in 2017?
Oh, yeah. So the Astros beat the Dodgers in the World Series. So another John Boy thing. The World Series DVD, like, you know, that has highlights of the season, and it's a lot of playoff stuff, obviously, because that's the main thing. It has a lot of behind-the-scenes footage, and there's, like, a couple things from that. I think I sent you one of the tweets that had screen caps from it, and the, like, you could see the area where the dude sat at the monitor. And there's one thing where like the guy right after the game, I think right after the Astros won Game 3, he's like taking the monitor down. It's in this relatively, it's a very open space but it's like, that's a player's only, like some of the media, like if you're a sideline reporter, you're probably sort of like Tom Verducci or Ken Rosenthal is like basically based down there. You're not, but you can't always tell exactly what's, I guess you could, but like, the point is it's direct access to the dugout. There was like Gatorade towels, like making sure nobody can see in from the open part from the field other than that sort of window from the dugout. But anyway, you could see it all sort of in play here. So that was kind of funny. Rob Arthur, Baseball Prospectus, he put out a piece where he like isolated the audio and you could actually, you could tell like in terms of like the decibels of the sound, whether it was either the trash can hitting or later on that year, including in the World Series, there's whistling. Both of them left like those signatures that were like noticeable. So like he didn't go through all the games where something like if MLB is investigating this, you could basically go through all the audio data and find out exactly where they did this based on that, because it leaves like a signature imprint or whatever. So that was an interesting article. Drellick and Rosenthal had two follow-up articles. The second one saying that AJ Hinch, who was the manager at the time, Alex Cora, now the Red Sox manager, who was the bench coach at the time, Carlos Beltran, a player, and who is now the Mets manager, all were involved in the scheme. And so Beltran at the time, like he was the guy who was credited for like stealing or picking up the tells that Yu Darvish was doing in his games. And so back up for one second. We've talked about this before. Like, stealing signs is one thing. You still have to hit the ball. So that's part of it. And, like, Yu Darvish, his credit, he had a really good, like, sort of heartfelt conversation with Dylan Hernandez. He also posted some on his YouTube channel where he basically said, look, yeah, there were instances, but I can't look back on that and say, absolve myself. I sucked basically. Like that was sort of the, and he's like owned this better than anyone could have imagined. Despite, you've seen like the replies to him, like they're just terrible. Like yep. They're terrible humans out there. Anyway, that said, the Astros have like gone sort of beyond the pale here. The other article from The Athletic, and then also subsequently confirmed through ESPN, Jeff Passan actually named the executive, who is former Baseball Prospectus podcaster and editor and writer, prospect maven, Kevin Goldstein, who was the farm director, the scouting director there. Now he's like special assistant to the GM. He sent an email in 2017 basically asking scouts if there were ways to use cameras to look into the dugout, like pro scouts, advanced scouts for future opponents. And then the scouts, like a lot of the scouts, like balked at this, like, what the hell are you talking about? We're going to get blackballed. You know, we can't do this. So there's like this postseason, the Yankees accused the Astros of using the whistling technique. AJ Hinch laughed it off. And I believe in one of the press conferences, he said, if anyone has any evidence, you should you should put your name on it and come forward. And guess what? People are. So, but not necessarily for 2019. But, The SNY reported that MLB did, in fact, uncover that there was, like, whistling. But I guess per this report, like, it wasn't enough to, like, say what the source was. So there's something going on. Like, and so the Astros are they're in this, like, perfect storm of, like, too much hubris at this point, right? Like, that's what they're going to end
up. What a month-ish they've had, right? Where they went from, you know, maybe not the most rooted for team. You don't win a World Series and still remain the underdog story. But, you know, I think that fans still, you know, were sort of indifferent to them after the domestic abuse scandal with Osuna, and now this. It is just, they are enemy number one for sure.
Right. And so, like, there's just something about, like, the way they've sort of gone about stuff. And, look, it's not going to be, like, they're not going to be like, well, you had this Brandon Taubman thing, so we're going to ding you for the signs even more. I don't think it's that. But imagine this. If they're still – MLB's, like, still investigating that incident because the Astros had a lot of stuff go wrong, including, like, how they attacked – their PR department, like, attacked the writer of the SI story, Stephanie Epstein, and took him, like, a week to retract it. He was given several opportunities to even apologize like a normal human would. Their basic, like, tenet, like, has been building the Astros way, has been like, we're gonna do it the way we want to do it, and fuck you to, like, anyone else. Like,
there it is.
Things. Yeah. So now it's sort of coming back possibly to bite them. Look, if you want to be cynical, I think nothing, like, no one's gonna go in. They're not gonna go in and, like, take away their championship. And look, yes, as a USC fan, it doesn't matter. Like, nobody cares that NCAA took away their title in 2004 season. Like, nobody recognizes that. Like, it doesn't matter. And that doesn't
recognize it, Eric.
But it doesn't deter anything. That's where MLB, so how MLB has to handle this is basically they need to, if the Astros are going to get, like, punished, like, righteously in this case or whatever, it's because the MLB wanted to drop the hammer and set an example. So if you just go back to that Red Sox thing, the first thing that they sort of absolved the Red Sox, or at least didn't fine them as much, it occurred without ownership or front office knowledge. There's no way that happened here. This was clearly, like, a pretty organized system, and, like, it probably went all the way to Luhnow. Who knows what the investigation's going to unveil, but there's no question, like, it did. And then, like, so imagine the one connection to Taubman is this. Like, if they're investigating Taubman and, like, talking to him, and all of a sudden he's like, because, look, he could be, I don't know if MLB would do this, but, like, if he's facing, like, some sort of, like, multi-year ban or ban from – he can't work in baseball anymore. Like, he could probably be successful in some other business or whatever, but he probably wants to still work in baseball. And one way he could do that is to cooperate the hell with MLB in their investigation. So if he could probably detail stuff or turn state's evidence, as it were. It's not like this is a criminal thing, so maybe not. But who knows what the investigation is going to turn up. But I think that's how they would get hammered, is just their sort of just being able to, like, not just so that nobody could do this and go undeterred. Like, the Astros probably already benefited to the tune of, like, they probably gained, like, $100 million by winning the World Series, like, in the playoff run. Brand value, etc. Just throwing a number out there, it's probably near that, right? And so, finding them. See, look, even your dog is angry. So, like finding them is not gonna, you know, do much. Like, it doesn't deter them, because if they got really close to winning the World Series again this year, let's keep doing this. Like, you have to make it hurt, right? So you were talking, like, draft picks. Front office people get suspended. I don't know what else you would do. I'm just saying that, like, that's sort of how you handle this. But I have no idea how it's going to actually be handled. But that's sort of what we're looking at.
Well, replacing the Cody Bellinger pace update will be the Astros lost the 2017 World Series
pace update.
Yeah. Oh, they lost another. Oh man. But we got. You have a Dodgers rewind. Craig has some questions for us, and we're going to do all that after this break. You hinted at it a little bit earlier when we were talking about Cy Young, but I know you have a kind of a Dodgers rewind I'm excited for.
Yeah, so we talked about Ryu finishing second. The first Cy Young Award, the Dodger finished second, and it was Sal Magley. He didn't even start the year with them. He was 39, 1956. He started the year with the Indians. The Dodgers purchased him from them in May. He was 13-5 with a 2.87 ERA. His 1.39 ERA plus led the National League. Don Newcomb won 27 games and won Cy Young. Don Newcomb pitched a no-hitter on September 25th that year versus the Phillies. The Dodgers entered that game a half a game back with five games left. The Braves only had four games left. They were ahead of them. And so that was a huge no-hitter in their pennant race. The Dodgers would eventually win the pennant on the final day of the season, including winning a start by Magley 4 days after. That was the last no-hitter by a Brooklyn Dodger and their 10th overall in history. He was 1-1 in the World Series that year, both complete games. He won game one. He lost game five but only pitched eight innings because Don Larsen threw a perfect game against him. So I was looking at this. That World Series is weird. So the Dodgers, right there, they lost to the Yankees five times, in their history, and most of those in the previous like few years. And then they finally win in 1955. They win the pennant again in 1956. They're up 2-0 in the World Series. They scored 19 runs in those first two games, and then they scored 6 runs in the last five games and lost the series in 7. They had one run in the final three games of that series. They won game 6, 1-0 in 10 innings at home, and then they lost 9-0 in game. If we talk about 2017, it was a crap game 7. Imagine Ebbets Field in game 7 in 1956, 9-0. Ugh, that had to be terrible. Oh, yeah, so second in both Cy Young and MVP that year. Don Newcomb won both awards. Magley was second. He was nicknamed the Barber because he would throw at people's heads and like just under their chin. Like that's abhorrent practice, but cool nickname, right? He led the league in ERA in 1950. He led the NL in wins and ERA plus in 1951. So like they didn't have the Cy Young in those years. He didn't, Jim Constantine won Cy Young won MVP as a pitcher in 1950. Magley would finish behind him. So in 1951, though, he was fourth in the MVP vote, and there was no Cy Young left, and he was the highest pitcher. So if there was a Cy Young, he probably would have won it that year. He was also linked to Newcomb in 1951 in that October 3rd, the third game of the playoff between the Dodgers and Giants. Newcomb and Magley started that game. Magley left after 8 innings, trailing 4-1, and I don't remember what happened after that. So Magley, he had a weird year. So like I mentioned, he's 39 in 1956, but he didn't start his career until like pretty late. He didn't debut until age 28 during the war, 1945. But then like he signed with the Mexican League like that winter or like maybe the next season. And the commissioner at the time, like, was trying to, like, prevent people from jumping leagues. So he suspended players who jumped to the Mexican League for 5 years. So Magley did – that's why Magley didn't pitch again until 1950 in the majors. He had those last 4 years of his career, 55, 56, 57, 58, he was the first guy ever to switch leagues in 4 straight years, like midseason. He started with the Giants in 55, went to the Indians. Next year, he went to the Dodgers. Next year, he started with the Dodgers, went to the Yankees. Then he started with the Yankees and went to the Cardinals. So, look, he had 30 WAR in his career in 10 years, 3.15 ERA, 1.27 ERA plus, excellent pitcher. Yeah, so that's today's Dodgers rewind.
The Barber. Is it weird, like, I abhor hitting players in this day and age, but I love hearing old-timey stories about it?
Yeah, because it happened in the past, and like unless you're literally talking about,
and they weren't,
Carl Mays like killing Ray Chapman.
Oh yeah, no. Don Drysdale had the whole thing where intentional walks How dated is that phrase now for a number of reasons now? All right. First question from Craig. Oh, wait, no. We got to do the thing. So it's time for...
Questions from Craig.
My mother would have been so upset with me if we didn't do the jingle.
I do love that jingle.
The first question. Do you think the Astros will make Bobby Thompson an honorary Dodger or Astro? That's from me. First real question. Back to the best of the 2010s. Eric, this is for you after making me do all the trivia questions while I'm sick as a dog. Can you name the three National League players to steal more than 200 stolen bases in the 2010s? That's the first question.
Wow. Okay.
Same thing. You get three strikes.
I don't think Juan Pierre lasted long enough. I'll say Jose Reyes.
I played this game and he was my first guest too, by the way.
Okay. And this is terrible because D. Gordon, Billy Hamilton.
Two correct.
Trying to think here. Just because he's been around the whole decade, but I don't know how much he's played. Rajai Davis. Oh, he's in National League.
Yep.
Never mind. I'm not guessing Rajai Davis. National League. Jimmy Rollins. Man, this is going to be bad. I don't think Matt Kemp didn't do enough. But you know what? I give up. I don't know.
Starling Marte.
Oh, wow. All right. I would not have got that. It would have taken me a long time.
Second question. I think you can do this. Name the one AL player to steal more than 300 bases this decade.
Oh, 300. Rajai Davis?
Yep, correct.
Okay, good. I was going to say. Yeah.
And finally, who led the majors in stolen bases from 2010 to 2019?
Okay, so D. Gordon didn't go into late. Billy Hamilton had like the four straight years where he was like, I think he was 56, 57, 58. I don't think he got to 322, so I'll go Rajai Davis.
Rajai Davis was second.
Go
with your gut. You were nibbling on it.
Billy Hamilton then.
No, D. Gordon.
It is D. Gordon. Okay.
It is D. Gordon.
Good for him.
Oh man, four more questions, then I can go cough my lungs up. Thanksgiving is one of the holidays that tend to be celebrated at a home. Do your family and friends tend to watch football, movies, play games, or do you have a dinner and then go on your way?
We will probably we'll play games, football depending on the house. If we, I used to have my sister's, she would rarely have the game on just because that's not her family style. But like, it's usually on in the background. It took a more primary role like when my mom was hosting for when I was growing up, but because I would turn the game on, but like turn games on. But, like, yeah, it's, like, more background for me. But we play a lot of games and, like, yeah, and then probably still leave, like, in the evening at some point. Not necessarily right after dinner.
I tend to do Thanksgiving here in Kansas City with my wife.
My wife.
Family, which tends to mean that Melissa and I help out cooking in the morning. I usually put on the Mystery Science Theater Turkey Day Marathon at that point.
Nice.
Once enough of her family shows up, I get overruled and football gets put on.
Yeah.
Then we eat dinner, and then, yeah, it's kind of a little bit of talking, but then home after that. I do think that should I ever get back to L.A. to hang out with my family for Thanksgiving at some point, I would make a game happen. We're a gaming family, I like to think.
Yeah, games are fun. The other thing I forgot to mention was another sort of fun pass the time thing is just to have the Twilight Zone marathon on, because those are more digestible, like a quick half hour, and then you can get back to whatever you're doing. So,
as we look back, I'm thinking of a favorite moment I saw in person at Dodger Stadium in the 2010s. I saw many, but I will pick the walk-off home run that won the NL West in 2016 on Vin Scully's last home game. Craig has pretty good ideas for what we're going to say, but he wants us to know. I'm sure Craig can guess mine. It's Juan Uribe's home run in the NLDS against the Braves. Not close.
So I think that's mine too. And the only thing that would come close to it is Kershaw's no hitter.
Sure,
but that's less of a moment.
Had I been there for that, that would have been.
But
interesting
the Uribe home run. That place was so loud, and like it just is one of those where you could like feel the stadium.
Mm-hmm.
And plus that was like a redemption year for Uribe, who was absolutely terrible for like 2 years and like left for dead basically. And just to sort of culminate his sort of his rise,
just
like
so much
was
neat things into that at bat, because there was this tension because they that if the Dodge went if it because it was game four, but if it went to game five, they'd be going back to Atlanta. The pitching would be kind of in disarray, so there was that angle.
Used Kershaw on short rest in game four, right?
They had the Kimbrel in the bullpen, which I wasn't thinking of at the time, but Twitter definitely reminded me of it.
Yeah.
And then I assume you remember, but I don't know if everyone remembers, Uribe was originally bunting.
Twice. He bunted Val twice. and then he's like, well, I can't bunt anymore. Let's just see what the old swingaroo can do. And then, yep, there it was.
It was great.
Yeah.
Question four. How close will Cody Bellinger, he's back, be to the LA Dodger franchise home run record when he enters free agent season, if he does? 30% some odd that he won't, you say, in 2023. He currently has 111 home runs, and the LA franchise record is 270, which is held by Eric Karras.
Yeah, he won't be close. Only because a part of me, like, I just want to avoid this question because I would say, flashback to 2011, Matt Kemp almost wins MVP. He that offseason signs an 8-year, $160 million contract. Richest in National League history up to that point. And I foolishly put a post up saying, here's where Matt Kemp's chances are, like, here's what Matt Kemp has to do to, like, set these Dodger records. Like, here's what, you know, he's going to be here for 8 years, obviously. and so, like, let's just project it out. Coming off the best season of his career, he's clearly going to be on an upward trajectory and never look back. And so, like, Bellinger's obviously younger, so it's different. But, like, yeah, I mean, he'll be over 200 for sure. It's 4 years, right, until – so, like, if he just averages, like, if he averages 35 a year, that's 140, so that puts him at 251. I think – something like that's reasonable, but like, even if it's like, so he's averaged 37 for his 3 years. Let's mark him up to 38 because he missed 3 weeks in 2017. So like, if he does that, 4 years at 38 is 152. So he'd be at 262. So he still wouldn't get to 270. So yeah, he's not getting to 270. He obviously could, you know, have a couple 40s in there or whatever. But yeah, it's weird things happen, man. Like, so it's a very hard thing to do. So yeah, I don't think he's going to get to 270.
All right, here it is, the food question. There will be plenty of turkey leftovers next week. Turkey is a go-to sandwich ingredient. Do you prefer a standard turkey and cheese, a turkey dip a la Philippe's, or a hot turkey sandwich with mashed potatoes, maybe gravy, maybe, or maybe something else with those turkey leftovers?
I generally don't like to put cheese on turkey, on a turkey sandwich.
That's weird.
I do sometimes.
Delicious.
But like, so the Felipe's, the Felipe's dip is the way for me. But like, just the leftover, just like a standard, like sort of like an onion roll or something,
mm-hmm.
and then just put a bunch of turkey on there and then some mustard and I honestly like not much else. Like, if there's gravy, sure, put it on there, but like I just like the next day turkey sandwich. It's an excellent like quickie meal.
Yeah, I do a lot of either just turkey sandwiches like you described, but with cheese, because I'm an American. And American
sure.
cheese, I might add.
I was just gonna say, do you put American cheese on there?
But a lot of times I'll just do, you know, the leftover special, which is heat up some mac and cheese, heat up some stuffing. A thing you can do to heat up that stuffing is use a waffle iron. It's delicious. And ooh, throw some nice turkey on top of that, put some gravy on it, and go to town. Sometimes when the leftovers are getting down, I will put all those ingredients on an onion roll. Nice. And it's delicious. Just carbs, 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 turkey, and some gravy.
The sandwich for me is like the, I just want something quick. Yep. But the most likely thing is like, is to just fix a whole plate and like put yesterday's meal on the plate, like, you know, with mashed potatoes, gravy, turkey, stuffing, and then you're set. I've not used the waffle iron, but that sounds delicious.
Gives it a little consistency. Let's, you know, hold whatever other sauce that you got going.
Well, that's what I'm going to do next week.
Yeah, and probably bearing any Thanksgiving Day breaking news, we'll be back after Thanksgiving, right afterwards, the early part of the week then, and hopefully we'll have some exciting news to talk about, but if not, you and I will be probably drafting the team of the decade.
Yep, the team of the 2010s. We'll have forgotten everything we've talked about by then. So, yeah, thanks for listening, everybody. I hope you all have a good Thanksgiving, and we will talk to you in December.